Welcome to Cloud Native Startup, where we explore what it takes to build a company in the open source cloud native ecosystem.
Hi, I'm Emily O'Meara, your host, and today I'm chatting with Jonathan Ellis, who is the co-founder and CTO of DataStax. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me.
Delighted to be here.
So I always like to start with sort of like introduction questions, which the one I'm going to start with is, what does your day-to-day look like now? And how does that differ from what your day-to-day looked like 10 years ago?
Oh, man. I guess that's a kind of a softball, but it's one that I've looked at over and over again because my self-image was so entwined with being a software engineer. And so as I've moved farther away from that, it's been a mind-bending experience of, do I still want to be doing this when I'm not writing code anymore? So I think that's probably unusual. I think for engineers who start companies, a lot of them have a clear idea of how that entrepreneurship is going to distance them from the act of writing code. But it kind of crept up on me, and I'm still making my peace with it in some ways.
Do you ever think about going back to just being an individual contributor, sort of like Mitchell from HashiCorp did relatively recently?
Yeah, I definitely respect the people who can make that decision because there's a lot of not just signals at the company, but like cultural signals that, you know, a CTO is a more prestigious position than a software engineer. But I think I'd be okay with trading that away. But what would be frustrating for me would be the sense of making progress at the rate of an individual contributor, as the title says, rather than as a team of 6 or 12 or 18. That's what keeps me from doing that, is the feeling of increased leverage or velocity that I can influence as an executive. And I'll add one more thing, which is that I'm scratching that coding itch on an extracurricular basis now. So I started, as my pandemic hobby, I started working on generative art. And so I get to write code for that. And that's a creative side that I hadn't explored before and that I enjoy.
And how does your identity have to shift when you start a company? And was there a moment actually when you started DataStax that you were like, okay, I'm not just an engineer anymore?
There's a few ways that that plays into things. So I think the first one that I still try to be aware of, and I probably don't entirely succeed, is that just by virtue of starting the company, you can't be just one of the team anymore. As much as you'd like to be in some ways, as much as I'd like to have a discussion about technical options to solve a problem, I need to be aware that by virtue of my position, that opinion that I'm expressing carries more weight than it does strictly on the merits of the opinion itself. And so you just need to be aware that there's like this distortion effect and compensate for that either by waiting longer to hear from other people before giving your opinion, or sometimes staying quiet entirely and letting, rather than push the discussion too far in one direction.
Fabulous. Well, let me take a step back here and ask you sort of, how did this all get started? And the question I wanted to start with was, how did you first get involved with the Cassandra project?
Yeah. So the prehistory is that for the first 10 years after graduating from college, I worked at, I think, 9 different companies. And so I was always had a very startup-oriented mentality, and I wanted to do a little bit of everything and get exposed to not just the software itself, but the impact it was having on customers. And I found that, you know, doing that at a small company was, I felt like I was learning a lot more than I'd have the opportunity to do in a more narrow role at a larger organization. The downside is that not all of those startups had a long trajectory. And so I did find myself looking for new jobs a couple times along the way. But then before the main influence before DataStax itself was working for a backup startup out of Utah called Mozy. And at Mozy, I created a petabyte scale object storage system. So basically Amazon S3, but specialized for backups. And this was in 2005, 2006. So that was fairly cutting edge stuff. And this illustrates why I was attracted to startups is that the trade seemed to be that Mozy knows that Jonathan Ellis had no track record of building infrastructure like this. So they were taking a chance on me. But at the same time, I was taking a chance on Mozy that I was employee number three or so. And so maybe that ends up going somewhere, maybe it doesn't. So the risk-taking seems aligned on both sides, and that was attractive to me. So then coming to one of the formative experiences that I had at Mozy was building what we called the feared massive database of backups that people had made. And so this was massive because it was all of our user accounts, but it was feared because there was limited redundancy. All of our actual backup files were triplicated, or actually we were using Reed Solomon encoding, so it wasn't exactly triplicated, but it was a similar level of redundancy that you can lose two copies or two fragments of the file and still be able to rebuild the whole thing. But our database, which was based on PostgreSQL, only had a single failover replica. And so the fear was if something went wrong on both the master database and the replica, then we were completely hosed. And the other thing we ran into with that is that we couldn't actually track one of the critical pieces of information that we wanted in that database. And that was actually mapping which users had copies of which files. And so for technical reasons, we needed to track that ownership in a many-to-many relationship. And relational database technology in 2005 couldn't handle that. And so I realized that this was a problem that as the industry moved towards as a service and towards cloud applications and mobile applications, where your database represents users from an entire country and not just from a single company's worth of employees, that was going to be a big pain point. And so I wanted to work on scalable databases as my next focus. And as it happens, Rackspace at about this time was looking for someone to build them a scalable database for their own internal infrastructure. And so that's how I ended up joining Rackspace, not to work on Cassandra. That's how it ended up working out, but with a mandate to solve data at scale or systems of record at scale.
So I'm just curious, before you had that experience at Mozy, did you have any interest in databases? Like, was there sort of a through line, or was this just this new problem opened up and you're like, wow, I'd really like to address that?
Actually, yes. At a couple of my jobs before that, I was kind of the database nerd. I was very interested in the performance characteristics of databases and how to write applications that would take advantage of that instead of clashing with that. I made some small contributions to Python object relational mapper called SQL Alchemy. So yeah, databases was definitely an area of interest before that.
So then how did you end up going from joining Rackspace to then becoming the project chair of the Cassandra project?
So the history there is in the summer of 2008, a team of engineers at Facebook open sourced Cassandra. And at the time, Facebook was doing open source as kind of an exercise in technical marketing, where they would open source cool stuff to say, look how interesting this is, therefore you should come join Facebook and work on interesting stuff with us, as opposed to open sourcing stuff to build a community to move the project forward. So they open sourced Cassandra, but it was with an attitude of, hey, it does what we need, and if you think it's interesting, then good luck. And so I joined Rackspace a couple months after that. My mission at Rackspace was to build a scalable database on a shoestring budget. So the Cassandra team at Rackspace eventually grew to 4 people, but it was never going to grow to more than that. And so you don't build a new database from scratch with 4 people. And so I was looking for a way to use open source as an amplification of our experts at Rackspace. So I evaluated Cassandra, I evaluated HBase and MongoDB. There were some other systems at the time that aren't around anymore. And the negative for Cassandra was that, in fact, as I said, Facebook was not building a community around it. So if I were to invest in Cassandra, then I would need to do community building as well as writing code. But I did think that despite that downside, Cassandra really had the best technical foundation for the next 10 or so years. And I think that intuition has proved to be well-founded. So I started maintaining a fork of Cassandra with patches applied to it on top of the Facebook repository. And when Facebook formally contributed it to the Apache Foundation, I went to the Apache mentors and said, hey, I'm the most qualified person you have to add as a committer here outside of Facebook. And they did end up adding me as a committer. And then when Cassandra graduated from the Apache incubator, I became the first project chair.
And then was there a moment when you decided to create DataStax? And if so, what was it? How did that happen?
Yeah, I know exactly when it was, because in the fall of 2009, there was a media company that was active on the Cassandra mailing list talking about using it for a new project. And then suddenly they just went silent. And I reached out to them and said, hey guys, what happened? And they said, oh, our boss said we can't use Cassandra for this because we can't get support. And so we're going to use this other NoSQL database that has a commercial vendor behind it. And so, you know, that was where I thought, okay, you know, not having a company for Cassandra is clearly a bug and somebody needs to fix it. And I'm probably the best person for the job.
Cool. And then how did you end up connecting with your co-founders?
So my co-founder, Matt Feil, I was leading the team that was writing code on Cassandra, and he was leading the team that was deploying it and running it as a service for application teams at Rackspace. And I was in San Antonio at the time. He was in Austin. He drove down to take me to lunch to talk me out of leaving. And in fact, I convinced him to leave with me instead.
That's fabulous. So what do you think is different about building a company that's based around an open source project? Sometimes it's called an open source company versus if you just have, you know, a straight SaaS.
Yeah, I guess fortunately I started DataStax 10 years ago when doing a straight SaaS was certainly more difficult than it is today. And so I'm not 100% sure. If I were doing it over again, there's definitely some attractive options to doing a straight SaaS model. It simplifies things. You're in complete control of the product rather than having to accommodate different environments, different flavors of Kubernetes, and even non-Kubernetes-based deployments. There's a lot of extra complexity that comes with, you know, a Cassandra-like approach versus just doing a SaaS. However, the main benefit and the reason that I would still be tempted to go with the open source model is that if done right, the marketing benefits are phenomenal. So this is something that a lot of people who aren't software engineers maybe misunderstand. There's this meme in the newspapers that you see, even from sometimes otherwise well-educated journalists, where they talk about open source as a way to get free labor, that I'll open source something like Cassandra and then magically people will start contributing features to it. And that's not the benefit of open source. The benefit of open source is that you're removing all of the barriers to entry. Anyone can go and grab Cassandra from Apache's mirrors or CDN without having to, you know, fill out a form or talk to procurement or anything like that. There's no obstacles. The second benefit is that there's no lock-in. People have that security blanket that if they go and use Cassandra, there's never going to be a bill that comes due unless they want to talk to someone like DataStax about value that we add above and beyond the source code that we've created. So the rule of thumb is that 1% of the people who download your software will give you feedback in the form of discussion forum posts or Slack messages or bug reports. And 1% of those will actually go on to contribute. So it's a tiny, tiny amount of the benefit that you get is the actual contributions versus the marketing effects.
Tell me more about the marketing effects. I actually often say that I don't think, this goes back actually to sort of mindset, that I don't think companies should view their open source project as like a lead gen. So I'm curious how you think about how you should think about your marketing, or if you think I'm totally wrong.
So I'm using these terms sloppily, and I'm sure, and you know, our CMO would have a cow because so I'm not using marketing in the sense of lead gen per se, so much as awareness. In fact, I agree with completely that you're not going to get sales by reaching out to the people who download your open source project. The people who are downloading it, almost by definition, those are going to be engineers who have a problem to solve. They're not going to have budget and they're not going to be inclined to spend money on other things around the open core, if that's your strategy. But it's like the meme, right? So step one, become ridiculously popular. Step two, question mark. Step three, profit. But so there is that question mark, but I do think that step one, become ridiculously popular, is a necessary precondition to step two of make successful enterprise sales. And I think that's what the question mark ends up turning out to be. So there are some blind spots that I had as a engineering founder, and one of them was the importance of having a good sales team and, you know, everything that goes along with that in demand gen and marketing and so forth. So my ridiculously naive idea when I started the company was that great software doesn't need sales because it generates its own interest. And because of the circumstances in which DataStax was created and the NoSQL hype wave of 2010-ish, we actually did get our first customers without a sales team. And so that probably blinded me to the importance of having a go-to-market team for longer than it would have taken me otherwise to realize that. So as it was, my memory is fuzzy here, but I think it was at least 6 months and maybe as long as a year after founding the company that we hired our first full-time sales representative. And that's way too long.
So to the extent that you can, what would you say that question mark period was for DataStax? I mean, how did you get from ridiculously popular to wild profits or whatever it is in the meme?
So I can give you the answer that it was historically for us, but I think that the trajectory would look different for someone doing something similar today. And so the answer for us circa 2011, maybe 2012, was we took Cassandra and we used that as the core of a proprietary distribution of Cassandra called DataStax Enterprise. And we added security features and search features and graph features to DataStax Enterprise that you didn't get as part of Cassandra. And that was our value proposition. Today, I think that the answer is what DataStax has been doing for the last year and a half, which is create this as a service offering. So we launched our Astra database as a service, I want to say in March of 2020, that's the emphasis for DataStax moving forward.
And what do you think were some of the biggest mistakes? You already talked about not hiring a sales team or a salesperson soon enough. Is there one or two other things that you would probably do differently if you did this again?
I can give you a fairly tactical answer, which is that we were relatively slow to adopt Kubernetes. And the reason for that was a solid technical reason, which was that Kubernetes was created for stateless workloads where there's no storage permanently attached or associated with the pods running the compute. And so obviously that's a very difficult model to run a database with. Nevertheless, I think we could have invested in Kubernetes faster than we did. I mentioned that we launched our database as a service a year and a half ago that is built on Kubernetes, and our strategy is very Kubernetes-centric around not just the service itself, but using Kubernetes to deliver cloud-like experiences to people running Cassandra on premises. But I wish we'd gotten there sooner.
Interesting. Were there any things that were sort of unexpectedly challenging?
Yes. So I'll give you one category that I think is useful to talk about, which is hiring executives. So coming into DataStax, I participated in hiring engineers, and I had a good idea of how to do that and how to create a representative technical interview that, and by representative, I mean representative of the work that engineers actually do, which is a lot more centered around reading code and understanding code than sorting a linked list on the whiteboard, which was, you know, the state of the art, you know, 15 or so years ago. So I think that as an industry, we understand collectively fairly well how to be able to tell if an engineer has the experience and the intellectual horsepower to be successful on a team. And it's just, there is no such body of knowledge when it comes to hiring executives. So I remember reading Mark Andreessen. He said in a blog post some years ago that if 25% of your executives work out, then you're doing very well. I think that's pretty accurate, maybe a little bit pessimistic, but it's directionally accurate that it's very difficult. And compounding the difficulty, if you have a single engineer that's a bad hire and, you know, he or she is not pulling his or her weight, you know, sure, that has a negative impact on the team. But if you hire a CMO who doesn't work out, that's 100 times bigger of an impact. So the stakes are higher and it's a more difficult problem.
Do you feel like you've gotten better at it, or is it even something that one improves on?
I think it's one of those things where good judgment comes from experience and experience comes from poor judgment. So I wish I had a shortcut to recommend. But yes, I do think I've gotten better, but it's from the school of hard knocks more than anything else.
I expect that that's one of those things where you don't make the same mistake again, but you're always making a new one.
That's right. There's an infinite number of mistakes you can make.
Exactly. And when you talk to aspiring technical founders, what are some of the themes of the advice that you give them?
I guess like most of us, my advice is geared towards the blind spots that I had. And so, you know, you're probably picking up some of the themes here, which is that I valued the technical side of things more than the go-to-market side. And so I definitely try to caution people around that and dial up your appreciation for how difficult and how valuable that other side of the business is.
Cool. Anything else that you want to add about the DataStax story?
Do you want to talk about building a remote first team, or is that something you've covered in sufficient detail with other interviews?
Actually, I don't think I've covered that explicitly ever. So I'm happy to go there. Particularly, did you start with a remote first team back in 2010?
Yeah, so one of the things that this is part of having worked on open source first and then starting the company second is that while I was at Rackspace, I got to work with and interact with people all over the world who were interested in Cassandra and starting to kick the tires on it. And I wanted to retain that as part of DataStax and part of our engineering culture. And somebody pointed out to me that as many and as good as the engineers in Silicon Valley are, there are even more and even smarter engineers in the rest of the world put together. So if I'm looking at, do I want to optimize for Silicon Valley or do I want to optimize for everywhere else put together? I'm going to go for door number two. And so part of that means that you can't privilege people who happen to be in an office. So we have our headquarters in Santa Clara, but when engineers in Santa Clara join a meeting, they join meetings from their individual laptops like everyone else. And so what that means is that, you know, even if there's three people in Santa Clara, they're not just looking at each other across the table while the person on the video screen is mostly ignored. Everyone's on the same playing field. The other thing that I like about having this design is that it's very merit-focused in a good way. And what I mean by that is, as a manager in a traditional office environment, you can't help but be influenced by things like, oh, Jonathan comes in early and stays late, or, you know, Jonathan tells funny jokes at lunch and I really like being around him. Like those stuff, significantly smaller factors in a remote first team compared to, does Jonathan write good code and participate in reviews and all the other things that his job is supposed to be about. So I think it's very positive. And so when I see articles about managers saying, oh, how will I know if my employee's not doing their job if I can't see them at their desk? And so, you know, I want to install spyware on their laptops so I can see what's on their screen. It's like, look, if you can't tell whether someone's doing a good job without knowing how many hours, if hours on screen is your proxy for the job they're doing, like you shouldn't be managing that team. And that's the problem that needs to be fixed.
Yeah, of course, you can also manage to not do your job if you're sitting in an office.
Right.
For all those managers out there listening. Well, fabulous. And actually, I'll ask one more question about the remote work before we move on from that. Do you have any like special insights on how to foster the sort of water cooler talk or like informal channels of communication that a lot of people talk about falling through the cracks with all remote?
Yeah, that's a bit of an open problem. I don't think anyone has a really great solution to that. A partial solution, and one that's unfortunately had a bit of a wind taken out of its sails during the pandemic, but the partial solution is to have in-person get-togethers over the course of the year. And that's having meals together and, you know, having face-to-face discussions really helps build the social capital, if you will, that you can draw on during the rest of your time working together. But no, I'm definitely interested in any other solutions that people have to that problem, because I think that is the big downside to the remote first team.
So if somebody wants to connect with you or learn more, or if they have the fabulous genius solution for how to fix this problem about remote first teams, how should they follow you or get in touch with you?
Yeah, the best way to reach out is by email. I'm JB as in boy Ellis, ELLIS at datastax.com. So I'd love to talk about it.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks, Emily. It's been great talking.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Cloud Native Startup. If you'd like to learn more about positioning, messaging, and go-to-market for open source and cloud-native startups, head over to my blog, positioningopensource.com. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. I'm at Emily O'Meara, and you can feel free to reach out on Twitter or on my website and blog with questions or comments. If you enjoyed this episode, also please share and help more people discover this podcast. Thank you, and we hope to have you next week.